this mysterious, elusive, ever-moving moment of now, the present, which is somehow the boundary between this fixed past and this open future. So in this talk, I'd like to demonstrate to you that the view that this temporality of our experience is not just metaphysics, or needn't be just metaphysics, but can actually influence the choices and decisions that one makes in discovering new science. And I'm going to do that in the context of a particular approach to the problem of quantum gravity that Raphael mentioned, causal set theory. So also, I'd like to encourage you to ask questions during the talk. I can't really see you very well, but if you kind of wave at me, then I'd really like you to ask questions during the talk and don't just save them to the end. I would much rather that you ask questions and we had a discussion than that I get through whatever material that I've prepared. So please don't hesitate to ask. So in pre-relativistic physics, time was thoroughly spatialized into nothing more than a fourth dimension. So in some sense, time as something special, something intrinsic to our experience, was lost in pre-relativistic physics. However, the revolution of relativity banished the concept of global simultaneity as unphysical. There's no global now in either special or general relativity. Physical time, according to relativity, or proper time, elapses locally along world lines, the world lines of observers like ourselves, or any material thing. And one reason that when we learn about relativity, we enjoy it so much, why it's so emotionally satisfying, is that this better scientific understanding accords with our experience and our intuition that time is local. So apparently, I learned recently that children find it very difficult, or young children are able to conceptualize the notion of order in time at a very early age. So they are quite happy with the concept of events that have already happened, with events that are yet to happen, that they're anticipating, and events that are ongoing. So the idea of ordering in time and the distinction between past and future is something which children learn and are somehow intuitively in tune with at a very young age. But the notion of time as universal, as measured by clocks and calendars, is something which apparently children have to get drummed into them. So they have to go to school and undergo a lot of education in order for them to be able to understand this notion of time as a global concept, something that can be marked everywhere and anywhere by the same global clock, the same global calendar. So children have to be trained to think that way. And then, of course, when they get to university and learn about special and general relativity, we have to tell them to forget all of that and go back to their more intuitive, childlike understanding of time as elapsing only locally. So relativity also restores to physics the distinction between time and space via the Lorentzian signature of the metric. So it has a plus minus plus 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 signature, and that distinguishes time from the dimensions of space. So something crucial about time has been recovered by relativistic physics. It has been rescued from the thoroughly spatialized notion of time in pre-relativistic physics. So that's good. However, general relativity also shows that the physical world has a four-dimensional character. It's a space-time. Space-time cannot be understood as the evolution of some physical three-dimensional entity. It has a thoroughly space-time and four-dimensional character. So, according to relativity, there's no global now, no universal present, no universal notion of simultaneous, and the physical world is a space-time, a four-dimensional space-time. I just want to mention, by the when I say four-dimensional, I just mean space-time. I'm not precluding the idea that the possibility that space-time is higher dimensional or is a Kaluza, has some small extra dimensions or anything like that. When I say four-dimensional, all I mean is that it's space-time rather than space. So there's no global now, the physical world is a space-time, and many physicists have concluded from that that the universe must be, therefore, a block. I'm going to just draw a block here. So this is space-time from the beginning of time, if it had a beginning, all the way to the end of time, if it will have an end. And everyone and everything, every material thing in the world, in the universe, traces out their life as a world line in space-time. So here I'm born, here I die, and here I am right now. So I'm 47, so it's kind of maybe accurate to put myself about there. Okay. And in this block view of what exists, everything, every event, past, and future is equally present, equally physical. So the future is as physical as the past. And this impression that I have of me being actually located on my world line right now, there, and that this spot, this special spot, is somehow creeping up that line and creeping up in a way that's inexorable, doesn't have, I can't stop it. It's going to reach this point no matter what I do. That impression is just an illusion. It's something to do with the brain, with psychology. It doesn't have any place fundamentally in physics. So this block view of the world is the reaction that many physicists have to relativity, to the idea that there's no global now, that the physical world is a space-time. So to do justice to this temporal nature of our perception, whilst maintaining the space-time nature of reality, space-time, the character of reality that's space-time, that's four-dimensional, a growing block seems natural. And this idea is associated with the philosopher C.D. Broad. So in Broad's view, the four-dimensional space-time in the past is real. And I couldn't resist quoting this verse from Omar Khayyam. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all your piety nor wit shall lure it back to cancel half a line, nor all your tears wash out a word of it. So that poetically expresses, yes.
Question.
Yes. I wouldn't say it rules it out, but I would say it's in tension with a 3+1 approach. There's a tension there. Yeah, I'll come back to that point. Yeah, thank you. So in order to realize this idea of space-time as a growing block, one thing you might imagine is just covering the top half, say, of this whole space-time, covering it up. And then gradually moving the piece of paper that you've used to cover up the top half, moving it away and unveiling or revealing this the four-dimensional space-time. And then my perception of temporality would have a place in the physics. However, that is in contradiction with relativity, because to do that, that would introduce a physical global time. So there would be some special, there would be a physical meaning to this global surface of simultaneity, and that's ruled out by relativity. So is it possible to realize this notion of a growing block within physics? And I'm going to show you explicitly that a model in which I think this notion is indeed embodied. Okay, so here's a plan, talk. So first I'm going to, the context of this model is within the approach to the problem of quantum gravity based on causal sets. So I have to introduce causal sets to you. Causal sets are discrete space-time, and they can grow classically. And there are models in which causal sets grow as, indeed, accreting blocks of space-time in a way that doesn't contradict the absence of a global preferred present, a global preferred time now. That's all, and the model, you'll see, is a classical model. Quantum theory threatens this recovery of temporality, and I'll say some very brief things about that, and then I'll end with a summary and some talking points. Okay. So the quantum gravity boundary is where physics is at its least and also its most unified. So the least unified bit is what's often stressed, and I don't disagree. Our description of space-time is classical, our best description is classical general relativity. And that is simply conceptually disunified with our best understanding of matter, which is as a quantum theory. So the struggles that we have in trying to find a theory of quantum gravity, a unified description in which space-time and matter would be on equal footing, they are not just technical problems, but conceptual problems. What would we even mean by such a theory? So it's really disunified at this boundary, physics. However, it's actually at its most unified, exactly at that position, because of the theory of black hole thermodynamics. In black hole thermodynamics, there is quantum theory, that's the quantum theory of fields on a space-time background. There is gravity, because we're talking about black holes, and there is thermodynamics. So the three areas of physics come together in a beautiful unity there. And it's the most unified that we've part of physics, exactly at the boundary where this extreme disjunction occurs. So that's an interesting tension there. Now, in working towards quantum gravity, most workers believe that at some stage science will have to make the what Jacobson and Parentani call the leap to a new conception. So when we develop new and better theories in science, those theories cannot be logically deduced from the science that's already been established. They're not just a logical consequence of what we already know. You have to postulate new things. But you can't just invent the new theory from whole cloth. You can't, it has to be grounded in our best current science. So to arrive at quantum gravity, we have to make a leap, this creative leap, from a position that's grounded in current knowledge. And identifying that ground, that grounded position from which you are going to leap, is itself a creative act. So at any stage in the evolution to a new theory, there will be diverse views about which aspects of our current understanding will survive and which will turn out to be what Jim Hartle calls excess baggage. The causal set approach claims that certain aspects of general relativity and quantum theory that we know now will have direct counterparts in quantum gravity. And they are the space-time causal order, and I'll say more about that, from general relativity, and the path integral from quantum theory. And it makes one main new hypothesis about the nature of the physical world, and that is that space-time is fundamentally discrete or atomic. So taken together, these three things, causal order, the path integral, and fundamental atomicity, form the bare-bones conceptual basis of causal set theory. The space-time causal order and atomicity furnish the kinematics of the theory, and the path integral provides a framework for the quantum dynamics. So I want to justify why causal structure is a good hypothesis for the structure within our current theory of general relativity that will survive in the quantum theory. So space-time in general relativity has a causal order, and you know that. It's the order that is given to you by the light cone structure. So for any point in space-time, a point which is either in or on its future light cone is to the causal future of that event. Any event which is outside the past and future light cones is causally unrelated. So B is to the causal future of A. A and C are causally unrelated to each other. Now, the epitome of general relativity is a black hole. You can't understand a black hole without general relativity. And our understanding of a black hole is in four-dimensional space-time terms. And in particular, it's in causal terms. So a black hole is actually defined in causal terms. It's defined as the boundary of the causal past of an observer who remains outside the black hole for all time. So another example is that Hawking's area theorem, which says that the area of a black hole, the event horizon of a black hole, cannot decrease in classical GR, and that which is the classical limit of the second law of black hole thermodynamics, is proved using global causal analysis. It cannot be understood in terms of three-dimensional physical entities. Indeed, there's also compelling evidence that the laws of black hole thermodynamics are actually just a special case of more general laws of causal horizon thermodynamics. And this has been argued by Jacobson and Parentani. And these causal horizons include not just black hole horizons, but de Sitter horizons and Rindler horizons. So this causal order, all this information about which points in space-time are causally related to which other ones and which not, this causal order, it turns out, unifies within itself a lot of information about the space-time. From the causal order, you can read off the topology, including the dimension. So if you don't know the dimension, but you just know the information about the causal structure, you can actually tell what dimension the space-time is in. You can tell the differentiable structure, and you can tell 9/10 of the metric in four dimensions. And of course, the causal order gives you it gives you itself. And this idea that the causal structure of space-time is its primary structure, is the most fundamental structure, goes back a long way and has been pointed out in various ways by many workers. So because of this, because you get 9 of the 10 functions in the space-time metric just from the causal structure. Space-time, I wrote up here, space-time in general relativity has a causal structure. Space-time in general relativity almost is a causal order. It almost is its causal structure. There's just one thing missing. Now, the missing tenth of the geometry in a continuum space-time, which is the missing bit, which is not given by the causal order, is local physical scale. So that is, for example, the duration in time between two events along some particular world line. And to account for space-time as we know it, we need to provide causal order and physical scale. Together, they will give you the full geometry. And discreteness does the job because we can count. And I also learned recently that that people can't tell the difference in length between sounds if those sounds are too short for people to be able to count, to measure the duration of the sound that they're listening to by actually just marking off, by counting to themselves how long it is. So if the sounds are too short, then people can't actually distinguish which sound is shorter than the other one. So order, this is a slogan that encapsulates this these results, that order plus number where number is giving you scale, giving you duration. So in this view, the duration of a time along a world line is just counting the number of space-time atoms along that world line. Order and number gives you geometry. Now, I put as the title of this slide that causal sets are the result of the marriage between causality and atomicity. So the two things go together in causal sets, married together in causal sets. But this atomicity is not just what you have to add to order to give you back the geometry, but it's also what's widely expected to arise in quantum gravity. So it's widely expected that the differentiable Lorentzian manifold structure of space-time will break down at the Planck scale. And fundamental space-time atomicity is perhaps the simplest way of realizing this expectation. The differentiable manifold structure, if it breaks down, it could be replaced by all sorts of things at the Planck scale. The idea that there's just nothing at all less than there on scale smaller than the Planck scale is perhaps the simplest thing you can conjecture. So this space-time atomicity is the simplest way to realize the breakdown of space-time at those smaller scales. And it happens to be exactly what is necessary if one is drawn to conceive of space-time as just pure causal order. If you want space-time for some sort of more philosophical reason to be just pure causal order, things being before or after other things, then space-time atomicity will do the job of completing causal order to give you the full geometry of space-time. So a causal set is a discrete causal order. So this marriage of causality and atomicity is not a marriage of convenience, not a shotgun marriage, but is the uniting of soulmates. The two concepts complete each other. So before giving you, I'm going to give you the formal definition of what a causal set is, but I'm going to give you an example first. And the example is more important to understand than the formal definition. So here is a picture of a causal set that's well approximated by two-dimensional Minkowski space. So let me explain this. The black dots are the elements of the causal set. This causal set happens to be embedded in a two-dimensional Minkowski space, which is this square. This is space, this is time, and the light cones go at 45 degrees. And the black, the elements are distributed in this embedding in such a way that in any large enough region of the space-time, there will be roughly the number of elements embedded in that region will be roughly the area of that region in some fundamental units. So the elements of the causal set, the space-time atoms, are distributed uniformly across the space-time. Now, the blue lines are causal relations. So for each pair of elements, if the two elements are causally related in the embedded in space-time in which they're embedded, then they're causally related, and you draw a blue line between them if there's no element causally in between them. So these blue lines are the irreducible causal relations. So you can see that this element is related to this one. But there's no straight line directly drawn between them, because you can get from this one to that one by a chain of other relations in between. So you only draw on the minimal number of relations which tell you by transitivity all the other relations, all the other causal relations. This set of elements, together with the information about which elements are causally related to which other ones, that's the causal set. The embedding space-time information, for example, the coordinates of those points, is not part of the causal set at all. And neither is anything like the length of these links. There's one bit of information per link, and it's just between that element and that element, the bit is one. Between this element and that one, then unrelated, so the bit is zero. So between every two elements, there's just one bit of information. So this diagram is called a Hasse diagram because it only displays the irreducible relations. If you drew on all the other relations which are implied by transitivity, then it wouldn't be called a Hasse diagram. So this depiction of the causal set is called a Hasse diagram. It has no dimension fundamentally. So on a computer, you would just write down, you would just have a list of all the elements, and then you would have a list of all the pairs of related elements, and that would be it. So there would be, there's no dimension information in that structure. However, globally within the structure, dimension is encoded. This entity, this causal set, is Lorentz invariant. If you were to do a Lorentz transformation on it, the resulting causal set would look just like this, because the points would be in different places, but the distribution would still be uniform, and the link structure would look exactly like this. It's highly non-local. You can see that some of these links stretch non-locally across the whole of this space-time region. And that's because this element here, which is linked to perhaps this one up there, they are actually, in the Lorentzian geometry, incredibly close to each other. The proper time between this element and this one is very small. Oh, yes? Yes, yes. So a Lorentz transformation will squash up the diagram in one null direction, stretch it out in the other null direction, and this distribution of points and links would look exactly the same. Yes. Are there other questions? The causal set is also, in a certain sense, relational. These causal set elements have no internal structure. Their only property in and of themselves is that they're units. They just have the number one attached to them. And they only have individuality. You can only say that this element is different from this element by virtue of their relationships with each other. So by the pattern of relations, you can distinguish this causal set element from this causal set element. But in themselves, they don't have any individual character. It's very austere, this structure. It's about as minimal as you can imagine a structure being. You don't need any of the sophisticated mathematical machinery of differentiable manifolds in order to understand this thing. You just need to be able to count. There are no real numbers in this causal set at all. And there's no background. So although I've shown you this causal set embedded in a Minkowski spacetime, the causal set itself has no information about the embedding. The causal set is just the elements and the information about their relations. And the claim that causal set theory makes is that on Planckian scales, this is what Minkowski spacetime is. But you don't have to accept that proposal to get some benefit or learn something from this picture. It shows you what Minkowski spacetime is really like. It demonstrates the Lorentzian nature of the geometry, the real geometry of our world. This is what the world is like. The world is a Lorentzian manifold. There are elements which are, in a Euclidean sense, very far away from us, but in the true Lorentzian geometry are extremely close. And these causal set, there are causal sets which are approximated by any Lorentzian manifold. And those causal sets have the same relationship to the Lorentzian manifold as this one does to Minkowski space. Those causal sets can be embedded in the Lorentzian manifold and in such a way that the number of elements embedded in any region of a particular volume is proportional to that volume in some fundamental unit. And the order relation between the elements, it matches the space-time causal order of the space-time in which they're embedded. Okay. So here is the formal definition of a causal set, just for completeness. So it's a set, it has a binary relation referred to, which is the order, which you can refer to as precedes. And this order is transitive, so if X precedes Y, Y precedes Z, then X precedes Z. It's acyclic, so there are no loops, no causal loops in the order. If X precedes Y and Y precedes X, then X is equal to Y. And it's locally finite. So between any two elements of the causal set, causally between them, in between them and the order, there are only a finite number of other elements. The first two axioms of transitivity and acyclicity say that this set is a partial order. The third axiom is what makes the set discrete and atomic. And these elements of C are the atoms of space-time. And the hypothesis that causal set theory makes is that the deep structure of space-time is a causal set. And at macroscopic scales, the order relation, the fundamental order relation precedes, gives rise to the space-time causal order. And the number of elements gives the space-time volume. The number is approximately space-time volume. And this proposal was made independently by Etuft, by Jan Mirheim, and by Bombelli, Lee, Meyer, and Sorkin. And the approach to quantum gravity has been championed, particularly by Raphael Sorkin. So quantum theory of causal sets, so that's the kinematics of causal set theory. It states that what the theory is built on is these discrete orders. Now, there's no apparent sense to be made of a canonical quantum theory of causal sets. To define a canonical theory, one would have to identify a Hamiltonian. To identify a Hamiltonian, you would have to identify some slicing of a causal set into space-like hypersurfaces. And you can just see from this picture that's going to be very difficult to achieve. And in fact, it seems that there's just no sense to be made of what you could possibly mean by a canonical theory. So basing quantum theory fundamentally on the path integral rather than canonical quantum theory, that's something which many workers in quantum gravity have, that's the conclusion that many workers in quantum gravity have come to, including people like Jim Hartle, Stephen Hawking, Raphael Sorkin, Renata Loll, Jan Ambion, that the path integral is a more a formulation, a framework for quantum theory, which is more suitable to a fully space-time view of the physical world. But for causal sets, there's no choice in the matter. We just can't get going with a canonical approach. So basing quantum theory fundamentally on the path integral, it requires new work to do. But for now, at this point in my talk, all that you need is the notion that path integral quantum theory is actually a species of generalized stochastic process. So quantum mechanics is a generalization of Brownian motion or a random walk. It's much more akin to Brownian motion, to random walks, than it is to any classical Hamiltonian theory. And therefore, as a warm-up for what we really want, which is a quantum theory of causal sets, it makes sense to construct classical stochastic models for causal sets, so random causal sets. And there's a vast array of possibilities for coming up with conjecturing probability distributions on causal sets. So for a random causal set theory, what should the probability distribution on causal sets be? How? Yes, sorry.
It is a really poor model. You cannot, for example, get conservation of momentum out of Brownian motion because momentum is not conserved. So why then are you more optimistic that it's going to be better here than it is for electron in hydrogen atom, for example?
Oh, I don't mean that Brownian motion is a good approximation to quantum mechanics. I mean that I'll show you a little bit more about what I mean later, but the structure of the theories is similar. I mean, in fact, the structure of the theories is almost the same at some level. So I don't mean that they're approximate. That they're approximately the same.
Path integrals for particles, for example, typically can be taken from time 0 to time 1. And they have the property of folding. I can go from time 1 to time 2. You don't typically take a path integral and move it to the spatial folding, only in the temporal folding. Are you dismissing that possibility as a statement, or are you insisting that your path integral run from plus to minus infinity in time?
So there are kind of two questions there. So the notion of folding is unlikely to be realizable for a path integral for causal sets, because to do that you would need to identify something like a space like hypersurface on which to fold your two propagators together. So the idea here is that the path integral is something more than just a calculational tool for working out the propagator between two the states on two hypersurfaces. That it has a fundamental status. I'm going to say a little bit more about it towards the end of my talk, but okay, so at this moment, I want to claim that the notion of becoming, this idea of realizing nature as a growing block, realizing space-time as a growing block, actually plays a heuristic role in the discovery of an interesting class of stochastic models for causal sets. So it's almost a proof that the idea of things happening and the notion of realizing a growing block and the idea of realizing becoming within physics actually played an active role in the discovery of this class of models. So I'm going to show you these models now. Okay, so the class of models are called classical sequential growth models, discovered by David Rideout and Raphael Sorkin. Let me show you one run of a particular growth. So in these models, a causal set grows element by element like this. So first there's nothing. Then one element is born. I've labeled it 0. And at each stage of this process, a new element, a new causal set element is born, comes into being, and decides stochastically, randomly, which of the already existing elements it is going to be to the causal future of. So the next element is born, and this one, and there's some probability for it to be to the future of the element 0, or to be space-like to it, not related to it. And it chooses, in this particular instance, not to be related. The one is not related to 0. And then another element is born. It chooses to be only related to 0. It could have been above one only, or it could have been above them both, or it could have been space-like. And there's a probability for each of those possibilities. In this case, it chooses to be above 0. And then the third element is born again. There's a number of possible ways that it can be related to the already existing element. This element, it just happens at random to choose to be above 0. And it carries on in this way. And just in my example, there are just 9 elements in this particular causal set, and it grew in that particular order. So there's a random process of continual births of new space-time atoms. No atom is born to the past of any already existing atom. Otherwise, any order of birth is possible. And here's another way of generating the same, resulting in the same causal set. So in this case, atom zero is born, and then the next atom to be born is one, that one there, and it grows in a different order, finally resulting in the same causal sense. So we want the two runs, this is the same causal set, just labeled in a different way. And we want those runs to be different representations of the same physics. The only thing physical about this birth order should be the order relation of the causal set that results. So it shouldn't matter, it shouldn't be physically meaningful that this element here is born after, it's the second one to be born. It shouldn't be physically meaningful that this one is the fifth one to be born. That shouldn't be physical information, because these two elements are causally unrelated to each other. There shouldn't be any physical meaning to the order of their birth. So the rest of this ordering relation should be pure gauge, should not have any physical meaning. These are just two different representations of the same physics. And the question is how to capture this mathematically. And that's what Rideout and Sorkin did. So general covariance and general relativity means that the coordinates on space-time have no physical meaning. And the analog here is label invariance. So the birth order shouldn't have any physical meaning. The probabilities of the two ways of arriving at the same causal set that I showed should be equal, and that should be true of any partial, any causal set that's generated by the process at any time. Any two different ways of arriving at that causal set should have the same probability. So this condition and a local causality condition called Bell causality, because it is the analog of the local causality condition that gives rise to the Bell inequalities, together severely restrict the models to a class called classical sequential growth models, which is specified by a sequence of positive real numbers. So these numbers are actually non-negative real numbers. So they are the relative, each T, so Ti, for example, is the relative probability of a newly born element choosing a set of elements to be its ancestors, to be in its causal past, where that set is of cardinality I. So if there are I elements in that set, then the relative probability of the newly born element choosing that set to be in its past is Ti. So this class actually contains some fascinating models. It's a classical stochastic process, so it's not quantum in any way. There's no interference between inherent here. But this class of models is already very interesting. So in one class, without fine-tuning these T's, these couplings T, the causal set that grows has a very suggestive character. It takes the form of a universe which grows to a certain size, recollapses to a single point, grows again, re-expands again, slightly bigger this time, lasting for slightly longer, and then recollapses again to a single point, and then grows and does that forever. And obviously, this is very suggestive of a model of a cyclic universe. Some of these models have very suggestive properties for cosmology. Okay, I'll just briefly mention that a second aspect of general covariance is that the questions that you can ask about the physics should also not refer to the labels. And in these CSG models, one can give a complete specification of all the possible physical label invariant statements that can be made and answered using in the dynamics. And this amounts to solving the problem, or a problem of time in this context. Now, these sequential growth models, I claim, embody the notion of becoming. The birth process is a physical process. And yet, the physical order in which the space-time atoms are born is only the order of the resulting causal set, and that's only a partial order. So here, becoming and the lack of a global time peacefully coexist in these models. It's the discreteness of causal set theory, somehow, that makes it easier to make sense of a growing block, V, view of the physical world. And in this, in these models, the present is the birth process itself. The present isn't to be identified with any particular collection of the space-time atoms. So it's very different from a view like this, where you would say the present is this hypersurface. So that's not the view here. The view is not that the present is to be identified with some of the space-time atoms. The present is the process. Okay. So here I just want to make some very brief remarks about physics versus mathematics. So this growth model seems as close as it's possible to come to capturing this notion of what Raphael Sorkin calls asynchronous becoming. So there's becoming, the causal set elements, the atoms of space-time, are coming into being. But in an asynchronous way, they're not coming into being in a linear order. They're coming into being in a partial order. Now, I can show you in real time this model process. I did. I showed you the causal set elements being born. But once it's said, or written down, or communicated in words and equations, this description of this model becomes somehow static. So once I've described it to you, you can conceive of the model as that you're conceiving of it in a static way. And even the showing doesn't really work for sequential growth, because any particular active demonstration of the birth process imposes on it this order which is not physical. So that when I showed you one example of the birth process, those atoms were being born in a particular order which is not physical. So there's something inadequate, even so, in this model to capturing the essence of the birth process being physical, and yet the birth process not having any linear order, but only a partial order. So the only resort that one can have here is, I think, to some kind of metaphor. And the metaphor that's being used is that the causal set elements that they're born. So there's something, the causal set elements don't just have properties, like their unity and their relations with each other. They have one other thing about them, which is that they are born. Okay. So that example already shows how this notion of becoming has been fruitful as a heuristic in discovering interesting models for causal set laws of motion. Which instead of laws of motion, they have laws of growth. But those models are only classical models. They're only really a warm-up for what we really want to do, which is quantum causal set theory. And I want to sketch now just a couple of different, but sort of overlapping as well, strategies for discovering quantum causal set dynamics. So here are two strategies that you might that we might pursue. So the first one is just to write down a path integral. So this is supposed to be the partition function where we fix the number of elements of the causal set. In other words, we fix the volume of space-time that we're interested in. And we postulate some weights, some amplitudes for each causal set, which I've written e to the I s of c, where s is an action functional for a causal set. And we sum that weight over all causal sets. And there is work that being done in this direction. So we now have proposals for causal set actions, in fact, for any dimension. And we can start to investigate a path integral or path sum here for causal sets by doing simulations now. And Sumati Surya has started to investigate this. And you can apply just a sort of quick and dirty interpretation of this path integral sum. Path integral. So you can ask which are the configurations, which are the causal sets which dominate this sum, and are they manifold-like? So are we getting something which would give us back manifold-like configurations, because most causal sets look nothing like manifolds. The one that I showed you is manifold-like. It was approximated by a Minkowski space. But most causal sets are nothing like manifolds. And one overwhelming worry about any discrete approach to quantum gravity is that the non-manifold-like configurations in a path integral or path sum are going to dominate. The bad configurations which look nothing like manifolds might be so overwhelmingly many of them that they dominate the sum. Okay, there's another strategy that one might employ, which is to try to do again reproduce the success of the classical sequential growth model. And the idea would be that instead of probabilities for causal set elements to be born and be born with certain relations to the already existing elements, they would be born with amplitudes. So we'd just replace probabilities by amplitudes in the model. So to do that, to follow the same line of argument that resulted in the classical sequential growth models, one would have to find the analog in quantum theory of the local causality condition that was imposed there. So this would have to be a condition of quantum Bell causality. And then we would, again, solve for the particular models that satisfied that quantum version of Bell causality. And here, we don't have such a condition. That doesn't exist so yet. And here, causal set workers join forces with quantum information workers. So this question of what the quantum analog of the condition that gives rise to the Bell inequalities is, in other words, the analog of the condition, the quantum version of the condition which would give you the Cyrilson inequalities instead of the Bell inequalities, that's something which quantum information workers are interested in, and so are we, and they can help us with this question. Yes. This S? No. Can I answer that afterwards? Yeah. Yes, I can show it to you, but it will take a little time. Let me finish. Okay. So in pursuing this strategy now, this generalization of the classical sequential growth models to quantum sequential growth models, we're trying, again, to realize within physics the notion of a growing physical world. So again, there are choices to be made in which directions to pursue physics. And in choosing to pursue it in this direction, one is trying to get hold of the idea of something of a physical world which grows. But in a quantum theory, that immediately throws up the question, growth of what exactly? So in the classical case, it was the growth of a causal set. And that the physical world corresponded to a one and only one causal set. So in the quantum theory, we have to say, what corresponds to the physical world in the quantum theory? And here, this direction of research in quantum causal set theory merges with becomes entwined with the quantum foundational question of what the physical world is in a quantum theory in general. And how do we make predictions about it? So here, I just want to sketch very briefly a particular attitude and direction. So again, in answering this question, what is the physical world in a quantum theory, we look again to the theory of stochastic processes. And again, I'm going to claim that quantum mechanics is Brownian motion. It's a generalization of Brownian motion, and I want to call it, it's Brownian motion on acid. So in a classical stochastic theory, where, for example, just bear in mind a random walk. So there are certain histories or trajectories that the walker can go on. And each history or trajectory has a probability, which I'm denoting a history by this by gamma. And P of gamma is the probability of that history. And suppose you want to know the probability of an event like the walker is at this position sometime between the 10th and the 18th step, something like that. Then you take all the histories in which the walker is at that position between the 10th and the 18th step. You take all of those histories, you add up the probabilities, and that's the probability of the event happening. So in a classical stochastic theory, this mu is a probability. And if the probability of the event is zero, then that event does not happen. That's the bare bones description of a stochastic theory, like a random walk or like Brownian motion. In a quantum stochastic theory, quantum stochastic process, which is which is the conception of quantum theory in the path integral framework that I'm suggesting, the measure of an event, again, like the quantum particle, the quantum mechanical particle is at a particular position between a certain interval of time. What you do is, instead of taking the probabilities of each history and adding them together, you take the amplitudes, complex amplitudes of each history, you add them together, and you take its modulus squared. Now, why you do that? That's just the rule. So the fundamental explanation of why you do this strange thing, why you have complex numbers, why you add them together and then take their modulus squared, that's not known. Why this measure takes this particular form. Now, the idea is that we take over from the classical stochastic case exactly the same rule for prediction. If the quantum measure of an event is zero, then that event doesn't happen. And this happens, in fact, to be true whenever the event is something like an instrument setting. If it's a pointer position, so it's after some quantum experiment is done, if this event is the pointer position is here, then when you calculate this sum over histories and take its modulus squared, if that is zero, then you predict that the pointer position is not in that position. So it's true, actually, for instrument recordings. And the proposal is that we extend this interpretational rule, this prediction rule for prediction, to all events, not just pointer positions, but events, microscopic events, which deal with the microscopic details of a quantum system. Yes. Yes.
On the right-hand side, if mu of event is zero, that does not mean that every A of gamma is zero.
Correct, yes.
In particular, an A of gamma could have been added to another question and give a non-vanishing contribution.
Yes.
That's part of your mystery.
Yes,
as well as the square
it is.
Square.
It is. Good, very good. So, yeah, so that, thank you for pointing that out. So now I've written again this rule that if this quantum measure of an event is zero, then we make the prediction that event doesn't happen. So in Brownian motion, the physical world is a single trajectory. But in quantum mechanics, it cannot be a single history for exactly the reason that John Cloud has just said. Because if this rule holds, then there are many, because of quantum interference, there are many events which have zero measure, which you preclude by this rule. And that will mean that you can't maintain the view that a single history happens. And there are many examples that show this, including examples which are based on the Koch and Specker theorem. All the famous quantum antinomies, suitably interpreted, can show you that you can't maintain the view that a single history happens in a quantum theory. So the Kaltenbecker theorem and the GHZ state, they all give rise to contradictions with between this rule and the idea that a single history happens. So we're seeking a description of the physical world that's as close as possible to a single history. So we'd like a generalized history, something in which the universe, the physical world, grows, that it has a character of being of growing. Can that be achieved? Can we have this generalized history having a growing character? Can we, like the walker in a random walk taking steps, or the causal set in a classical sequential growth model growing? And we don't know the answer to that question. It's work in progress by many people. And again, here I would point out that growth is a heuristic in motivating directions of investigation. Suppose you don't care that the physical world in a quantum theory should have this character as something which develops, which grows. Then there would be different. You would have different. You would pursue different directions in this program of identifying what the physical world corresponds to in a quantum theory. So let me just summarize very quickly, since I've run out of time. So relativity sets up a challenge to the notion of becoming, because it tells us that there's no such thing as a global physical now, and that it tells us that the physical world is a space-time. It has a four-dimensional character. Causal set quantum gravity takes the causal structure of a space-time in GR as its as being the fundamental structure that will persist, that will survive in the deep quantum regime. And it completes that causal structure by making it atomic. So the atomicity completes the causal structure because it can give the atomicity gives you physical scale and therefore geometry. This atomicity provides new possibilities for laws of motion for space-time, aka laws of growth. The absence of a globally defined time is compatible with a physical process of becoming, and the classical sequential growth models are examples of that. Things happen in a classical sequential growth model. They just happen in a partial order. It remains to be seen if this is still possible in a quantum world. And perhaps we can put this struggle to realize a growing, the notion of a growing block in a quantum theory, maybe we can put it to work. Maybe the requirement that this growing world find a place in quantum theory will guide us towards the correct quantum dynamics for causal sets. And I'll end there. Thank you.
The questions. Traditionally, we ask if any students have questions first. Any student who wants to ask a question? If not, then we can open it up to general questions, where, of course, the students can still continue to ask questions if it occurs to them.
So in any theory where you have any sort of quantum theory, if you have a certain quantity which is sort of dynamical, which can be one way or another, then you would expect to have something like quantum superpositions. So no matter the fact as to whether you have the particle going through one hole or the other hole in a two-slit experiment. In the context of this of quantum gravity, then you'd expect that to apply to causal structure. So you'd have something like superposition of different causal structures. So not a simple probabilistic distribution, but an actual something like a quantum superposition. How would that play out in this approach?
We don't know. That's because we don't have a quantum causal set theory to investigate to answer your question. But you can. All I can say is that it throws up a very difficult challenge for us, which is, as you say, because the causal set is space-time and it is causal structure. If there's no background causal set, there's no background causal structure. So the idea that the dynamics should be causal is something which you would have to define in somehow terms intrinsic and not reliant on the background, because there is no background. So, and I have to say that we don't know at all how to do that. So that's kind of one way that your observation is challenging us. I mean, it's not kind of playing out because we don't know how to meet that challenge right now. But yeah, but indeed, that's a fundamental aspect of trying to build a quantum theory, a dynamical theory, dynamical quantum theory of causal sets.
This question, I think, was asked earlier, and you had promised an answer, which
yes,
I'm not sure I understood or you gave. Maybe you did. There was the Z of N equals to E to the I summation. What was the capital N about?
That N was the number of elements in the causal set. So the causal set summed over there, I was imagining them to be all of the same cardinality.
So if N... N was equal to 1, there would be a single e to the I s, or
one? Yes, yeah.
Okay. And what fixes N?
Your physics of interest. So if we want to describe the whole universe, then the observable universe, then N would be say 10 to the 240, because there are 240 Planck volumes in the observable universe.
I have a question about, can you describe the dynamics of matter in this context?
In causal set theory? So at our current stage of development, we have very few models of matter on causal sets. What we do have is, for scalar fields, both a discrete D'Alembertian operator, which would allow us to propagate a classical scalar field on a causal set background. We also have a quantum theory of a scalar field, again, on a fixed background causal set. These classical sequential growth models, not quantum, but the classical sequential growth models, they can be interpreted in some sense as models in which there is some kind of matter on the causal set. So some matter that's sort of like icing matter. So that you can just reinterpret exactly the same model as having some kind of matter on the causal set. But it's only classical. So we don't have any model in which both the causal, well, we don't have a quantum model of causal sets anyway, but and we certainly don't have a quantum model in which the causal set and the matter are quantum. And we don't have any models in which we have fermionic matter or tensorial matter. I mean, things like vector fields, again, are very difficult to put fundamentally on a causal set background, because there's no fundamentally no differentiable structure. So we're at a very primitive stage, I would say, in terms of understanding matter.
Yeah, I have another question. maybe concerning causality. So in your approach, you describe causality as being an intrinsic property of space-time. But there is another, maybe more traditional approach to causality, or let's say more conventional or more operational approach to causality, is to say that causality is not really an intrinsic property of space-time, but it's a property of things, stuff, particle, wherever it is, that moves in space-time. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems that you're here making a choice, which is a fundamental choice to assign causality to space-time and not to matter. Do you have comments on that?
So there's causality, but there's causal structure. So they're kind of different, as Lucien was kind of pointing out. So as regards causal structure, meaning this order relation amongst the causal set elements, I think that has to be fundamental. I mean, the causal structure of space-time is real. It's physical. It's because the causal structure plus information about physical scale is the geometry. And for gravitational waves, for example, the space-time geometry is physical. It carries energy. I mean, it's a material. Space-time is a material. A material entity. So in that sense, the causal structure is physical. In the absence of other sorts of matter, it's physical. So in that sense, the causal structure is in general relativity is physical, and causal sets is conservative about that. So it takes that causal structure and says it's still physical in the quantum theory. Causality, as in something causes some other thing, that's a much more difficult concept. I mean, I don't really understand what it means, in fact, sort of in an intrinsic way, for one event to physically cause another event. So if you're talking about causality in that sense, then I'm just floundering, really, because
I was more thinking about
very Very
I was more talking about the first one,
the
that
first
is
one, right.
For
okay.
many people, you know, in the field, it's kind of impossible to imagine an operational notion of measuring causal structure without any form of matter. So it's hard to, you know, imagine talking about causal structure without stuff.
Yes, okay. So this is not an operational framework. It's not an operational approach. So it takes the gravitational field as being physical, just as one would take the electromagnetic field as being physical. I mean, I suppose I don't see any reason to deny the reality of the gravitational field and not deny the reality of the electromagnetic field. It's true that to measure something for us, you and me, to measure something, we need matter to do it. That's true, but I think that matter, those experiments merely reveal what is there. And for me, space-time is a physical entity, just as the electromagnetic field is a physical entity.
So we'll take one more question, and then I don't know. Oh, okay. Okay, two more questions, and then I don't know if Faye wants to say anything about. Answer to Tibra's earlier question about what is S, what is the action in that e to the S here.
Yeah, I have a question about causal diamonds. I imagine that it's easy to define a causal diamond with just two time-like separated events. And the question is, can you compute the area of the intersection of the two light surfaces? And is there a way to compute the entanglement entropy for a causal diamond, possibly related to?
I'm sorry, I just didn't catch the question. So is there a way to calculate the area of... Sorry.
Is it possible to calculate the area or the intersection of the two light surfaces that define the causal diamond?
The two what, sorry?
I think the words were the two light surfaces that define the causal diamond. Is there a way to calculate the area of their intersection? I guess it means, you mean the corner, basically. And then the second half of the question was, is there a way of computing entanglement entropy in the causal set? Right, something.
To calculate the area, of a causal interval, for example, is that the?
Yeah, I think that's what. It
is. Right. So yes, it's just the number of elements. So for example, you could take this element here, and an element. That one there, for example, then the causal interval between them is the region of space-time, which is all the elements in the causal future of this one, and in the causal, oh, I've forgotten which one I chose, the causal past of that one. And that indeed can be calculated. You just find all the ones which are linked to the future to this one and linked to the past to that one, or related to the past with that one. Just count the number, and that's the area in Planck units. And the entanglement entropy? Well, that's a very good question. So Raphael and Yassim and Yazdi have been pursuing investigating a proposal for the entanglement entropy of a quantum scalar field on a causal set. It's kind of giving rather puzzling answers right now, but yes, in principle we can address that question. Yeah.
So last question.
The first question is how you get Lorentzian signature of the manifold out of this structure. The second question is, do you have the notion of motion of those fundamental atoms, and even probably temperature of those atoms?
Okay, so...
Thank you.
So let me take the second question first. So the atoms are... there. Space-time atoms, so they're not atoms of space. So they're each atom is something like that. So it corresponds to it's an idealized event which has a position in space and a moment and a time and occurs at a time. So it can't move in the sense that once it's happened, it's just it's sort of fixed in the past, so there's no notion of motion of the space-time atoms. Remind me of your first question again, so that Lorentzian, yeah. So the Lorentzian signature, it's inherent in the causal order, because without Lorentzian signature, there isn't a causal order. So, for example, if you have a Riemannian geometry, one where the signature is all pluses, then there are no light cones, and there's no notion of causal order at all. There's no ordering amongst the elements. And if you have a signature which is, say, has two minuses and two pluses, then there's no partial order, because in a two-dimensional surface, you can go around. So the two minus directions, for example, you can consider a two-dimensional surface spanned by those two negative directions, those two time directions. You can go around in a circle in that two-dimensional surface. So you get loops in time if you have two times. So again, there's no partial order if you have anything other than a Lorentzian signature. So if you get a manifold at all from a causal set, then it has to have a Lorentzian signature. That's the only kind of geometry you could get. So, yeah.
Okay, so as I mentioned, Faye will be around for a couple of more days. And now there should be, if you go out to the bistro, a sort of high tea reception for everyone. So we can thank Faye again.